The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
In the past few hours, 27 people have been killed by Israeli fire while heading for an aid distribution centre in Rafah. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza. The Israeli Defence Forces have said they fired shots after identifying quote-unquote suspects near the aid distribution site. It follows an attack in roughly the same location on Sunday that killed 31 and another yesterday which killed 3. For the latest on this, we're joined by Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, and also for analysis by Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Good morning and welcome to you both. Greg, we'll start with you first of all. Can you describe the situation as it has been, I suppose, described by both the Israelis and by the health ministry in Gaza? What are they saying, and are the reports conflicting?
The reports are conflicting, and they have been for several days now when similar incidents have been happening. Each morning, Palestinians are congregating before dawn about a kilometer away from these aid distribution sites. And the idea is once the sun comes up, they are allowed to proceed to try and collect parcels of food. And so it's at these locations where people are congregating that there have been repeated mass casualty incidents. The Israelis, in their statements, have always insisted that they are not open fire on people at distribution hubs, which is technically correct. This is happening 800 meters or a kilometer away.
The rules laid down by the Israelis more or less insist that that's where they wait.
Right, exactly. And this is sort of an inevitable consequence of if you're only going to have a handful of places where people can come and pick up aid. There are meant to be four of these sites across the whole of Gaza serving 2 million people. You are going to have large crowds that need to congregate in particular areas, and you are going to then have a problem with crowd control. And that is what we have seen every day over the past 3 days, is that these large crowds start to form. The Israelis open fire on these crowds. And as you say, the Israelis have told these crowds to form because of how this mechanism is set up.
Now, is it possible that there's any truth in the Israeli assertion that they have identified Hamas militant suspects and therefore that's the justification for their fire? I mean, they're firing not from like 2 meters or 10 meters away. They're firing from afar, and they're using drones and helicopters to strafe the areas. So how credible are the Israeli contentions?
Well, I think, particularly at this point in the war, not very credible. I mean, we have heard time and time and time again when the Israelis have carried out strikes on hospitals, on schools, when they have killed large numbers of civilians. The explanation is always that there were suspicious people, there were members of Hamas or other militant groups present, and they very rarely have provided any evidence, any documentation to back up these claims. So I don't think there's any reason to take them at their word here.
Now, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said about the casualties, not today's, the latest are 27 killed today. He said, "I'm appalled by the reports of Palestinians killed and injured while seeking aid in Gaza yesterday. Called for an immediate and an independent investigation into these events and for the perpetrators to be held accountable." And of course, the Foreign Ministry of Israel responded criticizing him and saying it was a disgrace that he didn't mention Hamas in his comments.
Right. And I think for the UN, there are two issues. One is, of course, they're going to call for the perpetrators to be held accountable. And you know, we've seen over the past 20 months again that that does not happen. But I think the more immediate issue for the UN is they would like to go back to distributing aid in Gaza themselves. They had a system set up before March, before Israel imposed its blockade on aid going to the UN. There was a system by which the UN was able to reasonably well hand out aid to people without these sorts of incidents, because it was much more decentralized, because it wasn't four distribution hubs across the whole of Gaza. There were hundreds of places where people could go and collect food and other essentials. The Israelis have barred the UN from doing that. But I think so long as they maintain that prohibition on the UN and other aid agencies, we are going to see more incidents like the ones we had seen this week.
Now, this is a system set up by the Israelis and the Americans themselves. So any incidents like this that do occur are firmly to be laid at their door. This is the system they set up, and this is the system that has proven fatal for so many people.
Right. And what has happened this week, the UN, other aid groups have been warning for months that exactly this sort of thing was going to happen, even if you didn't have these shootings this week. You look at the number of people who have been able to collect aid. We're talking about, you know, a few thousand families each day that are able to collect these parcels of food from distribution hubs. They're reaching only a small fraction of Gaza's population. They're handing out mostly staple goods, dried rice, pasta, flour, things like that, which you can't eat unless you have water to cook them in and fuel with which to boil that water, which many people in Gaza don't have access to right now. So the distribution hubs, they're not reaching enough people. They're not giving them what they need in some cases. They're not distributing the right food. And they're creating these situations in which large numbers of people are being shot. All of that, again, was predictable and was predicted by the UN and other groups.
So are we to inevitably conclude that this system set up in Gaza by the Americans and the Israelis is actually a fig leaf? In other words, we are distributing aid, therefore we're doing what the international community has been pressurizing us to do, but it's simply not enough. It's only a fig leaf.
It's a fig leaf, and it also seems tied up with Israel's war aims. You know, one of the reasons why the UN has refused to participate in this new aid mechanism, it's refused to have anything to do with it, is it violates humanitarian principles of neutrality, wherein you should hand out aid to people in a neutral way without being party to the conflict. The way this foundation has been set up, this aid mechanism, putting all of the distribution hubs in the south, essentially compelling people to come to the southern half of Gaza if they want to pick up food, pick up supplies, it looks like it's tied in with Israel's goal of depopulating the north of Gaza, forcing the entire population to move to the south. So it's a fig leaf, but it's also something that, you know, might have a military strategic purpose for the Israelis.
Also, the fact that the boss of the GHF, as it's called, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, I mean, he resigned because he said he couldn't do that job and adhere to the principles that he espoused, which are those very humanitarian principles that you refer to. And when you see the scenes, given there are so few distribution centres and so many people seeking aid, I mean, they are reducing people to a rabble. They are so anxious to obtain food for their families, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. It is dehumanizing.
It's incredibly dehumanizing. And the argument that the Israelis made as they were setting up this foundation was that under the old system, distributing aid through the UN, that some of that aid was being diverted or stolen by Hamas and other armed groups in Gaza. And that was probably true to some extent, because Hamas has been able to feed its fighters for 20 months. So obviously it was getting food from somewhere. But there's no reason to think that this new mechanism is going to prevent that from happening. You're giving people big parcels of food, which are meant to last them for days, which they then have to walk kilometers back to their tents, carrying these parcels of food, store them in their tents. That can very easily be stolen or extorted as well. So there's no reason to think that this new mechanism will even solve the problem that the Israelis say they're trying to solve, which is diversion by Hamas. And in the meantime, you are creating all of these other problems.
Now, the task, I mean, they were boasting that they had managed over a few days to distribute 7 million meals, which would be 3 meals almost per person, I suppose, if there are 2 million people in Gaza. However, the task, if you're dividing the population between each of the four distribution centres, it means that each distribution centre has got to provide food for 500,000 people. Now, that is a gargantuan task.
Right, it is. And the idea is that each box that is distributed at these hubs, it's meant to supply a family of 5 people for between 3 and 4 days. So twice a week, Every head of household in Gaza has to come back to one of these centers and collect a new box. They haven't been able to do that. Granted, it's only been a few days since this was set up, but they haven't been able to serve anywhere close to that scale of people so far. And again, this is just a limited amount of staple food that's being handed out. They're not handing out medical supplies. They're not handing out, obviously, drinking water, fuel, things like that. They're not making any provision to give people temporary shelters or clothing. It is bare bones, subsistence level rationing. And even that, they're not able to do it at scale.
So in terms of how people are living in Gaza, I mean, you need clean water. If you want to maybe sanitize grubby water, you've got to boil it or whatever. So the question of energy, how have people been managing for energy? Are they burning everything in sight to try and generate energy, or are there still cylinders of gas, for example, available?
They're basically burning everything in sight at this point. You did have, up until several weeks ago, there was some gas that was available. It was increasingly expensive because the blockade that Israel imposed back in March meant that supplies started to run out. And so a small cylinder of cooking gas would cost the equivalent of hundreds of dollars. Most people couldn't afford that. And so they have taken to burning wood. They have taken to burning clothing. There are some people who have been able to essentially jerry-rig machines that burn plastic. So plastic debris that people are finding across Gaza, they are burning that as fuel with which to heat water and do their cooking. Obviously, that then releasing a lot of toxic chemicals into the air. And so you talk to people who are living in some of these makeshift refugee camps in Gaza, and they talk about these plumes of black smoke that are often hanging over the camp from neighbors burning plastic in these contraptions that burn it for fuel.
Do you see any end in prospect? I mean, the war aims of Netanyahu have yet to be accomplished. Do you see this as an endless war?
It looks that way unless the United States decides that it wants the war to end. There was a bit of hope late last week. There were some more ceasefire negotiations brokered by the United States, and there were some reports in Arab media late last week that both Israel and Hamas had agreed to the terms of a new ceasefire. What actually happened was the Israelis agreed, but they agreed to a deal that wouldn't permanently end the war. They agreed to only a temporary 60-day truce that would secure the release of some hostages. Hamas refused that because they insisted, as they have for more than a year now, that they want a permanent end to the war. That sticking point, that hasn't changed. We've all been talking about that for many, many months now. Israel being willing to only accept a temporary truce, Hamas wanting a permanent ceasefire, that is still the sticking point in the negotiations. And I think unless the Trump administration is willing to put real pressure on the Israeli government to change its mind, to accept the permanent ceasefire, which, by the way, most Israelis want at this point. But unless there is American pressure on the Netanyahu government to do that, I think this war is going to drag on.
Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, thank you very much for joining us. Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, listening to that conversation. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
It does seem as if the endless war is in prospect, because with a short ceasefire, maybe 60-day ceasefire, Netanyahu will still maintain that Israel's on a war footing because the ceasefire is only temporary, and therefore he will see himself immune from any kind of moves to affect him politically.
Yes, and obviously that is one of the primary concerns that he himself has. But he has enough support from a minority of Israelis, including the politicians from the far-right parties, to succeed in what he's doing. The key thing, as Greg was saying, was, of course, the position of the Trump administration. And as of now, the Trump administration does not have the willingness to take this on. Trump could more or less call a halt to this war at virtually any time. Israel is so dependent on U.S. arms and U.S. technical support. You know, the United States even has permanently based U.S. military within Israel. It's looking after one of the most world's advanced X-ray band radar systems for anti-aircraft or anti-missile coverage. So the United States could really pull the plug on this almost at any time. and is not prepared to do so at the present time. Other countries may be putting more pressure on Israel, at least symbolically, including Britain. But Britain could do far more if it wanted. It can just obviously recognize the state of Palestine. It could start all arms sales, many arms going into Israel from Britain, including ones being made in Britain by Israeli companies. But the British government, again, is not prepared to do this at the present time. You're getting very strong words coming out of the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, but essentially at the center, under Keir Starmer, the British policy will not change. So we're stuck here where we are. The big change, of course, is the huge change in international opinion on Israel, and more polling coming out from European countries to show that Israel is being regarded more and more as a pariah state. Mm. But under Netanyahu, they're prepared to take this. So it's a very long-winded answer. Yes, it looks like it's going to go on.
Has Israel been using its own history, the history of part of its population, that of the Holocaust in Europe, as an excuse, really, for doing what it's doing? In other words, as a protection, so people can't criticize Israel because of the Holocaust, which gave it much of its population from Europe. Although there were, of course, Zionists there from the 19th century who had the ambitions for literally taking over the land of Palestine.
Yes, very strong ambitions for that. If you go right back to essentially Herzl in the 1890s, and certainly in the 1920s, there were very powerful Zionist groups who saw the need, the essential need, mainly because of the treatment of Jews in Eastern Europe, the essential need to actually have their own state. There was a time many, many years ago when it was actually talked about Uganda as a possibility, and the British were interested in that. But you're going back well over 100 years for that. No, this is a very strong element. But the problem is, I think that as time goes by, trying to use the horrors of the Holocaust to provide justification for what Israel is now doing just isn't holding. And there's always also been the developments over the last 40 years of a sort of a history almost of not so much the Holocaust at all, but the development of Israel and the way in which so much of the Nakba in 1948, when Israel got its independence, was a planned maneuver to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible from areas that the Jews were hoping to settle. And they ended up in refugee camps. Well, of course, the biggest, most recent, most remote, closest one was Gaza, but refugee camps in the West Bank, in Jordan, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, all of that. And of course, dispersal of Palestinians, I think there's something like 7 or 8 million Palestinians dispersed across the rest of the world outside of Israel. So you have a situation in which this was planned right through for the purpose of providing Jews with a safe state. I think one of the problems here is that many, many Jews are getting increasingly concerned about what is going on. You know, I have good friends who are really hugely worried about what Israel is doing. And when you have these very large marches in London, you get quite large Jewish contingents supporting the Palestinians in their desires. So Israel is losing out in that sense. But under Netanyahu, with the state of current Israeli politics and the political arithmetic of the Knesset, they can continue to do what they want. And I think it's only going to be a change in Washington that will change that.
Finally, Paul, we should talk about Ukraine, because Ukraine has had a significant military success over the weekend in taking out, it would appear, according to reports, more than 30% of Russia's long-range bombing capacity, the kind of bombers that have been doing huge damage in Ukraine. They managed with very cheap and, I suppose, readily available technology and a lot of ingenuity to inflict a serious blow on Putin.
Yes, and the point here is that these bomber bases were a long way from Ukraine, a couple of thousand, 2,500 miles from Ukraine in one sense, yet they were actually able to be subject to an attack which damaged a lot of these weapons, a lot of these planes. Now, these planes are the ones which were carrying missiles of one sort or another for use against Ukraine. And of course, being based so far from Ukraine, the assumption was that they were completely safe. That's turned out not to be the case. And as you say, ingenuity played a part in this. The problem is that Russia does not currently produce most of these planes from its own resources. Many are actually produced in what is now Ukraine, in the Soviet days. So actually, it's a real problem for the Russians. And I think it's going to be watched right across the world in every military. People are going to realize that in a real sense, war is changing and relatively small, cheap drones can do huge amounts of harm. We're not seeing those drones in non-government hands to speak of at the moment. That may well change, but it certainly shows in a very graphic way that, as you say, ingenuity and the way in which these technologies were used really is something of a game changer as far as warfare is concerned.
And the question is whether this will feed into any peace talks, because Russia is still holding its hard line. They want to maintain territory and they want to reduce the size of Ukraine's military and so on and so forth, which is not acceptable to Ukraine. But whether or not there's a message in what happened over the weekend for Putin and that he will listen carefully to that message, which is victory is not as inevitable as he thought.
He may do. I mean, I think there will be people. The trouble is that within Russia at the present time, the people who would be prepared to tell him as it is will probably fear for their own futures, because it is being run in a very autocratic way. But yes, you're absolutely right. It does change things. Really, either Putin gets the message that you have to negotiate and negotiate fairly quickly, or else so much pressure is put on Russia, once again by Trump, that they actually come to the negotiating table. Either of those is possible. I think it is certainly possible that these attacks that we've seen in the last 48 hours are so significant that the Russians may begin to think again, but we don't see any sign of that at the moment, at least in these latest talks in Istanbul. While there was no progress on the big issues, there was substantial further progress on the essentially the exchange of prisoners and this extraordinary thing of many thousands of bodies of dead soldiers being returned to the countries that they came from.
On that note, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. Paul Rogers, Professor Emeritus of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.